I said to Tim that he needed no introduction, and I wouldn't give him any, but you're not so lucky. Tim is someone who the hat rack isn't made large enough to hold all the hats that he wears. As you know, he does audience research for a living, but is also the only person in the room who can name the members of the Dinwiddie Colored Quartet and how many spin-offs there were from December Bride. He's finishing his television guide. What is it, the 7th edition? 9th edition? But in between, he's working for us, as usual, on copyright initiatives as chair of the ARSC Copyright and Fair Use Committee. And he's going to come now with Rob Bamberger and tell you about initiatives that the committee's undertaken in the last year. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you for not having too many stories about how young you were when I came to my first conference.
Do you want to get set up, Rob, while I introduce this? Do you need to use the podium?
Oh, I didn't realize the podium would be clear.
Up to you. We have three parts, the first part of which is going to be Rob Bamberger from the Library of Congress, who is busy setting up his equipment right now, so I'll vamp a little bit. All right. The Copyright Committee has been working on some very active initiatives in the last year. We're going to report to you first on a related project, not under the Copyright Committee, that Rob is heading, National Recording Preservation Board's study of audio preservation, particularly as it regards to copyright, in this session at least. That's just one of the things it's looking at. Then I want to talk a little bit about what happened in England recently, because it's a model for what could happen here and in other countries. I think it's very important to understand, especially after years of sort of the assumption that the forces of greater copyright are so powerful, nothing can touch them, and we have to just sort of duck. And that certainly is not what happened there. A lot of things are in flux, and I think it's a very instructive example. David Patmore, one of the members of the Copyright Committee, who is in England, very involved in the CHARM project there, not able to be here today, but he has provided information, which I will convey to you. Finally, we have a report for you on the still in progress, but moving along, a 5-point plan that ARSC's Copyright Committee is developing. This is a recommendation to the government and to regulators of changes that we as an organization would recommend, assuming board approval of this, be made to the copyright law of the United States to facilitate both preservation of early recordings and access to those recordings. And there's some indication that there, although this is not going to be easy, not a cakewalk, as they say, there could be some opportunities here, opportunities that certainly weren't around 10 years ago. So those are the three things we're going to talk about. I'm going to try to spend about 10 minutes on each. Rob, how are you doing? Are you, I give you Rob.
You mean in terms of being ready or more cosmic?
Either. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. As has been noted, the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000, among other provisions in establishing the National Recording Preservation Board, also requires a study on the state of recorded sound provision with an eye to a number of different issues and dynamics, one of which is copyright. And what I'd like to do with you is share some of the major issues and concerns that are in the draft of the copyright chapter. I feel a little sheepish about this because I'm, in effect, parroting thoughts at you that are already second nature, ideas you not only already understand, but understand because you've experienced the tangle of copyright in your jobs and avocations. The point here is for you to let me know, ultimately, in some discussion in the days that remain, if there's some facet of the issue that needs to be addressed that I don't appear to be referencing, or something that could be better framed. Bear in mind that the audience for the study will be policymakers and others with decent minds and active curiosity, but probably not your knowledge base. It's not apparent to me that public policy can do an awful lot to untie the Gordian knot of copyright, though I'm certainly open to being persuaded otherwise, but at least we need to raise greater awareness outside of groups like ARSC of the threat to deteriorating sound recordings of all types and all formats, to which copyright may be a contributing cause. Now, I am so thrilled to have access to Tim here because I've really wanted to buttonhole him for several months now to see if we can't get the Lifetime Network to foot the production costs for a Lifetime movie that captures all of the sweep and emotions of copyright law and how it can poison young love. I can see, you know, could their passion be protected in the public domain? So I have a plot in mind where a very accomplished woman becomes a librarian at a major university. She falls in love with a young man who has recently joined the office of the university's general counsel. They have a lightning courtship. They have so much in common. They discover they had each bought all 10 seasons of Friends, and they, you know, all sorts of things. So anyway, they're sitting in this very fancy restaurant, and she suspects, but she doesn't know for sure, that the steak tartare that's about to be served to her is going to have an engagement ring nestled on top of the horseradish. Meanwhile, a strolling guitarist has been coming by the table playing such numbers as Running Wild, I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise, and Would You Rather Be a Colonel with an Eagle on Your Shoulder or a Private with a Chicken on Your Knee? And she starts laughing, and he says, what's so funny? And she says, well, those songs, they were all published before 1923. They're in the public domain. He doesn't think that's so funny. He thinks that a restaurant that has a strolling musician performing songs beyond the reach of ASCAP, CSAC, and BMI should have a cheaper wine list. They begin to argue. A woman at an adjoining table remarks later that everyone had thought the couple had calmed down until someone overheard one of them bring up something that sounded like TNDA. Well, the domestic violence police officer who has seen this in so many domestic disputes during the last 9 years sighs deeply and says, no, ma'am, it must have been the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998. But what really puzzled us, says the woman, is that the girl started screaming about Sonny and Cher. Ah, says the police officer, sadly, that would be the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Well, then that makes sense, says the lady. And what do you mean, ma'am? Well, the last thing the girl said before pushing back her chair and hitting the guy with the wine bottle was, I'll be damned if I'm going to spend the rest of my life with someone who thinks that if it would protect intellectual property longer, more people should ski into trees. Don't let a copyright lawyer fool you when they say they're doing work pro bono. Well, keep my idea in mind. That only takes us to the first commercial break. Well, first of all, the study is going to observe that the letter of copyright law is incompatible with digital technologies and subverting education and preservation. As you probably know, there is a group examining Section 108, and in a February 2006 background paper, they note, the use of digital materials implicate copyright in ways that analog materials do not, and that copyright is one of the major hurdles to effective digital preservation. Next, copyright law does not extend sufficient latitude to libraries and archives to preserve and furnish copies of recordings for research and use in education and to fulfill the mission of these institutions. We're finding as well that it's also quashing opportunities for collaborations and partnerships in the preservation area that would prevent redundant efforts. Some of this pressure comes from within the university or library community and the desire to avoid litigation. And so many of the august institutions for which some of you work are doubtlessly overly cautious in the interpretation of copyright law and therefore in turn very likely interfering with the uses of sound recordings. There was a statement submitted to the NRPB at one of our hearings from a doctoral candidate in ethnomusicology who argued that availability of the recordings that he is researching would provide working class and ethnic communities access to their own expressive culture. And with so few of these recordings available, he noted that contemporary artists may have no knowledge whatsoever of the decades-long history of the styles that that they are working in. He also noted the practical and more immediate problem that doctoral work is expected not only to be publishable, but indeed to be published. Academic presses often require that authors have secured necessary rights, which graduate students are unlikely to have the resources to secure. And he noted, for this growing group of scholars, the result is a need to reconceptualize the project, often in ways that dilute its academic merits, as time and productivity pressures demand that something come from the work, and quickly. Third point, if congressional staff get nothing else from the executive summary of the study, it will be this, that preservation and access have become joined at the hip. We are all familiar with the high expectations about access that computer and wireless have created. Those among us who still remember typewriters can appreciate the miracle. Those born after the early 1980s who've grown up with these technologies seem to feel a colossal sense of entitlement. Would that we could throttle them at times, thus realizing that we have become the fogies we once said we would never become. But there's a high expectation, and for many of you in the room, these wide expectations of access have become fused with the challenges you're facing, because you could probably cite a number of instances where you may hold collections of important recordings but do not hold the rights to make these recordings available, except perhaps for on-site listening. A respondent to one survey remarked, "It does not make sense to catalog anything until we are sure that we'll be able to use it." Here the core question is, to what extent does a lack of rights to the performance and or the underlying material in a sound recording collection discourage preservation of that collection, irrespective of its uniqueness, the cultural importance of the collection, or its physical state? Andy Lancet, who is among us, appeared at the New York public hearing, submitted a statement, and noted that he refrains from putting up on their website much of the music and poetry programs in their archives that do not fall under the coverage of the blanket license fees paid by NPR to ASCAP and BMI. He noted an occasion when the copyright on some classical concert recordings from the 1980s happened to be unclear. The holders of the recordings wanted WNYC to totally indemnify them from any potential claim of infringement. But here's sort of the punchline. Before they would agree to the release of the materials for scholarly purposes to the New York Public Library and the Museum of Television and Radio. And Andy remarks, such an atmosphere dictates that such materials will not be made a priority for preservation. One university librarian in a statement characterizes, I won't say whether it's a him or a her, as part of a rebel group that makes available what I feel I can make available, publicize what I can publicize until someone tells me we can't do it. This individual noted that this posture has yet to create any problems and opines that owing to corporate mergers and such, the vast majority of copyright holders probably have little idea what they truly own. It's ironic that some of you are doing their due diligence for them. Part of the danger here is that with respect to the condition of sound recordings in a specific collection, fate makes no distinction between recordings that are legally accessible or not. Either class might be in jeopardy of being lost or not, but copyright issues may influence what's chosen to be preserved, and the loss of the recordings themselves may not figure as strongly as we'd like. A serious corollary being that potential funders may be more attracted to projects where the recordings can be used once saved. One statement submitted to the board says that access is the trump card of digital. Additionally, we have to speculate that copyright considerations may be discouraging private collectors from donating their collections to larger institutions out of concern that the recordings will disappear into a black hole. And whether this disinclination to donate risks the loss of important collections that may already be endangered physically or will end up being disposed of improperly by heirs. How many of us collectors have experienced making the phone call that came a day too late? Well, a consequence of much of what I've summarized here is that copyright law addressing sound recordings is so complex that it invites scorn from those who have to live with it actively. And that law, of course, is ignored by everyone else. There's no disputing that there are individuals, groups, and websites that knowingly violate copyright law and make in-print protected recordings available for free. But what becomes increasingly apparent is that the law governing sound recordings, particularly pre-1972 sound recordings, is so impenetrable and viewed by so many as overly prohibitive that institutions that are usually law-abiding in nature are violating the law, or certainly pushing the envelope, to make out-of-print works available for what they view as defensible purposes. Law that is too complex to be understood is likely to be ignored when even responsible individuals and institutions either cannot find clear guidance in the law or find it so restrictive to their mission that the community develops a dismissive attitude. However, all of that said, solutions sometimes create unintended consequences, and one needs to be mindful that congressional intervention, even if it appears at first to be a good thing, may carry other freight. There's always the prospect that legislative changes could dispel some of the fog without necessarily broadening access and could instead simply make it more difficult to operate under the radar screen or to push the envelope with impunity. Well, Tim, for that movie, I'm going to have to find some way to get that guy and girl back together in the final petabyte.
Well, she has to triumph. That's what's
important. I think so. But my remarks make clear, it won't be easy. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. If you're not keeping abreast of the work being done by the National Recording Preservation Board, you should. Is there a website that...
NRPB.loc.gov.
You should check that. Moving along, I promised to give you a short update, and I'll read some words here from David Patmore regarding the English situation as one that can inform us. We had hoped to have David here or have him here at least by phone or something. Unfortunately, that didn't work out, so I will not affect an English accent. That would be a disaster. But I will certainly give you a framework. Backstory here. In 2004, the European Union staff was asked to make recommendations to the EU on intellectual property. They rendered a report regarding recording specifically, which recommended that the recording term in the EU, which is currently 50 years, not be extended. And they gave the reasons why. This was not an official action of the EU. It was a recommendation by their staff, but it was contrary to what the international record companies had been pushing for, obviously, and stirred up a good deal of fuss at the time. This has been reported in the column in the Ars Journal and other places. Chairman of the intellectual property group, and I can't get the names exactly right, rotates among the EU members, and the coming term was going to be an Englishman, Minister of Culture in England, and there was some feeling that he, who was very close to the record companies, as is Prime Minister Tony Blair, would try to push the EU toward extension during his term. What happened was that this issue was raised in England first. The Blair government was very much for extension. There was a pushback immediately, particularly from the political opponents of the Blair government, who are legion in England now for many reasons beyond copyright. The Blair government, as all good politicians do, punted and asked a commission be set up. What do you do when you're in trouble? Appoint a commission. A commission was appointed. It was chaired by Andrew Gowers, Gowers, former editor of the Financial Times. He was appointed by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and his task was to report back on the entire intellectual property framework in England, to recommend what actions, if any, the government should take. Gowers, being very close to business himself, again was thought to be a friend of the industry. The industry lobbied very heavily to this commission for extension, as they said, to harmonize with the United States at 95 years, including, if possible, retroactively. But there were many others who filed as well. There were ads taken out. There were letters in the newspapers over there. Work that was done in this country, in the United States, was put on the table, including the work by the Council on Library and Information Resources, the CLIR, one of which Steve Smolian and I worked on, another one by a lawyer by the name of June Besick, which pointed out the problems, some of which Rob was alluding to, that exist in the United States because of our rather heavy-handed framework and long terms. Those were all taken into consideration by Gowers and his staff. Nonetheless, the record companies were extremely vocal, and especially through Tony Blair, to try to move this their way. A scandal erupted midway in this. This is chance, I guess, in that the entertainer Cliff Richard, the singer from the 50s, was very close to Tony Blair. And it was, in fact, loaning him his villa for vacations, was giving him favors. Well, the political opponents picked up on that in Parliament, excoriated Blair for seeming different interests here, which was kind of a black eye for the industry and for the Blair government. At the end of 06, in December of 06, the report was finally issued by Gowers. The report covers many areas of intellectual property. There are three principal areas of recommendation by it. It's available for free on the web. I'll give you the website in a moment if you'd like to download. There's a lot of very interesting and very factual information in here, studies that they commissioned. But the three areas were that should be stronger enforcement of legitimate copyright law, and a lower cost to business to enforce copyright law. This comes from smaller copyright owners who are unable to enforce their copyrights because of the cumbersomeness of litigation. But the third point was copyright needed to be a balance of rights between the public and private interests. It needs to be enforceable, it needs to be strong, but it needs to be balanced. And in the area of balance, specifically regarding copyright term for recordings, their conclusion was that no, it should not be extended beyond the 50 years that now exist in England. Moreover, there were several statements that actually it should be shorter, that economic analysis indicated that anywhere from as little as 7 years to perhaps 25 years economically provided return for investment for industry, and beyond that provided 1 or 2% additional revenue, highly skewed to a very few holders. Lisa Marie Presley gets some money, but nobody else, none of the blues singers, none of the people who recorded get anything out of the extension. So it was highly skewed and very small, and therefore, if anything, it ought to be reduced. They didn't make that recommendation. They said leave it alone. The Blair government, in even more trouble in 06 than it was in 05, simply adopted the recommendation. So that is where it stands in England. The record companies have vowed to move on to Brussels and fight the fight again there and try to get England's determination overturned. Obviously, they have two strikes against them at this point. Just briefly, this is what David Patmore said about how this played out, and I'll read his words. First, the groups represented in the filings with the Gowers Commission were a fairly broad church. I like his phrasing. The librarians opposed it from the British Library down, and American work, including the Council on Library and Information Resources report, were of tremendous value here, as did the British Academy, which brings together all the country's top university academics, regardless of discipline. In addition, there were many other special interest groups opposed to it. On the other side, there were really only the record companies and their employees and artists. So a lot of noise, a lot of filings from a lot of disciplines. Second, we had a receptive ear in the form of the Liberal Democrats. Although a minority party, they did carry some clout in Parliament and were supportive of small business, such as all the reissue companies, transfer engineers, graphic designers, etc., who would be put out of work. Third, Gowers himself was very strong on copyright enforcement for the legal term, so there was no hint of him being anti-copyright in principle. This, combined with his very strong support for competition as an engine for economic growth, I think played well with the Treasury, who may have seen the record companies as being rather complacent with the terms as it presently stands, quote, the world owes us a living, etc., and without the energy that a highly competitive environment might generate. Those are David's words, and those, I think, give you a little insight into the politics and the need for allies and the business, hard-nosed business evaluation that went into this. And the end of the road was no, that copyright from beyond 50 years is unsupportable. The rest of the report was favorable, you might say, to business. Easier enforcement, lower costs, but for a legitimately defensible term. So that's factually what happened in England. I can take questions later on, but I do want to finish with what the 5 points are that your committee, your Copyright and Fair Use Committee, has been working on. These were presented to the NRPB with Rob at his hearings in New York. They were published in the winter newsletter, which I presume you all got. If you've lost your copy, Mike, it's on the website. In the winter issue. The 5 points are this. First, to place pre-1972 recordings under a single understandable national law by repealing Section 301C of Title 17 of the U.S. Code. That's the provision. Title 17 is portion of U.S. Code which covers copyright. Title 17 is the, Section 301C, rather technical term, is the one that says that any pre-1972 recordings will remain under state law until 2067, as it stands right now. So that's the one that throws all pre-72 to state law. There has been feeling, and even Rob reflected some of this, that maybe that's not such a bad thing. In fog, you can get things done. I think the Naxos decision in 2005 was a severe blow to that. It showed that in the internet era, a hard line taken by a single state, in this case New York, can affect everything. Because if a Naxos can't sell their historical recordings in New York, they simply eliminated the catalog from distribution throughout the United States. There is certainly nothing to stop other states which are very strong on copyright, like California, for enacting certain similar kinds of laws. And it doesn't matter if Idaho thinks differently. We're a national economy. One state can effectively, in the era of the internet, close down distribution. I think that's a feeling that we still have to discuss, but it's one that in the post-Naxos era, I think, has taken on a different turn. Repealing Section 301C, making federal law applicable to pre-1972 recordings, all recordings, would mean that everything I'm going to say beyond here then would apply to those recordings. Right now, any change in federal law has no effect on old recordings. The second, then, assuming the repeal of 301C and federal law applies throughout, would be to harmonize the term of coverage for U.S. recordings to that of most foreign countries, i.e. 50 years. I will credit Sam Berlofsky and discussions with him. I don't know if he wants to be credited with some ideas on this. The original thought was to repeal Bono, repeal the 20-year extension from 75 to 95 years. Practically speaking, it's very difficult to get Congress to repeal something that it's done, particularly something that's been upheld by the Supreme Court. However, a driver, an engine behind much of the copyright law extension in the last decades has been to harmonize U.S. law with international protocols, many international treaties, and the term harmonization does carry a lot of weight. What's been lost of that, of course, everything's been harmonized except recordings. Here we're very much out of harmony with what's going on in the rest of the world. So harmonizing would have the net effect of reducing the term from 95 years to 50 years. There might be some negotiation there. There are some countries that would be apoplectic for rights holders who would lose their Elvis Presley early recordings, their My Fair Ladies, and pretty soon Beatles stuff, which is, you know, fast going to be 50 years old. However, there are some countries that are 75 years. There are none that are 95 that I know of. So there might be some compromise there. But the term would be to harmonize our laws more closely rather than being the one that has the longest terms in the world. Third recommendation would be to legalize the use of orphan recordings, those for which no owner can be located. There is already a bill in Congress, wending its way slowly through Congress, with the support of the RIAA and other business interests to do exactly that. They're for it for a whole lot of reasons I can go into. It doesn't apply to pre-72 recordings because of everything I said previously, but if that were lifted, then automatically you would start to have some freedom without fear of lawsuits and litigation to use recordings for which you cannot find the owner. The fourth recommendation would be to establish a compulsory license to allow the reissue of abandoned recordings. This will be more controversial. This means if you don't put it out yourself and you keep it out of print for extended periods of time, someone else can reissue it. Record companies don't want to lose any control over anything, so they're not going to like that. On the other hand, ARSC has some allies in this. The American Federation of Musicians and AFTRA have both gone on record as saying they're in favor of this because their members, their big labor unions with a presence in Washington, their members are being hurt by the fact that their own recordings can't be made available because the record companies sit on them, and they want the ability to do it. So we would have allies in that. The term of how long they have to be out of a print before this would take effect has to be debated. Some would want it longer, some would want it shorter. The AFM and AFTRA are recommending 2 years, which seems very short. But for some period of time, if a record company will not make something available, then there would be the right to use it under terms set under the law. They couldn't simply keep it off the air, off the availability by setting the rates very high. And there's precedent for that in other areas. The fifth recommendation that ARSC would make would be to change U.S. copyright law to allow the use of current technology in the preservation of sound recordings by nonprofit institution. There's a whole series of sections, some of which Rob referred to, and there's a Section 108 task force at work right now on those sections to make under federal law, remember, federal law, greater leeway for institutions to make digital copies. They're very limited in what they can do now. To share copies between institutions so that the cost isn't duplicated. And to allow digital copies to be made before the recording actually has begun to deteriorate. Believe it or not, the law as it now stands says you can't make a digital copy until it's already starting to go bad, which makes no sense at all. So there's a raft of suggestions in this area, which I think would probably find a sympathetic ear. However, they have to apply to pre-72 recordings, so you come back to that first recommendation that the federal law has to be uniform. So those are the five recommendations as they are being formulated right now. The committee is still working on them. We're going to have a committee meeting at lunch today, as a matter of fact, on this subject. We're interested in your input to it. Either we'll take a few questions in a moment or individually to the committee members. Your president, Sam, is very interested in this area, as am I, of course. So let us hear from you. With that, I think that's the presentation, and we'd be glad to take any questions that you have. Sam, could you? Oh, I'm sorry. Before we do that, I asked Sam if he would make a few comments on further steps for the five-point plan, particularly involving other organizations.
Thanks, Tim. The first step, of course, as Tim mentioned, is to refine the five points We've even talked about a 6-point. I mean, lots of things that will help. What I sort of hear in Washington from those who follow legislation, copyright legislation, is parts 1 and 5 would be rather easy to get through, or relatively easy. Part 1 being applying federal law to pre-72 sound recordings. The easy way, the reason that would probably go well is that it's providing a more or less black and white 95-year term for something that has no defined term right now and doesn't fall under DMCA. You've read about the webcasting rules, which will drive small webcasters out of business if the Copyright Tribunal recommendations go forth. If you webcast pre-72 recordings, they won't apply to you. So we should have more webcasts of those, incidentally. And then, of course, number 5 is that of allowing someone to copy a recording before it's deteriorated. I would assume that part of the copyright law was made for torn books. You can't microfilm a book until it's actually torn, until the acidic paper is starting to become brittle. It makes sense. You can still read the words even though the paper is brittle. But you don't want to restrict recording preservation to something that's already ruined. So what we're trying to do is strengthen these points and then build a larger constituency. So a few months ago, I met with Jerry McBride and other people, the Music Library Association, which also has a very active copyright committee, to see if they might join ARSC in issuing this 5-point plan. And the Music Library Association had a joint meeting with the Society of American Music, the old Sonic Society, SAM, and though they have no copyright committee, they're somewhat interested too. So as we do this, the plan is not to work, as long as Tim's been working on this with all the meetings, and just put out a statement. We're going to do what we can and try to meet with legislators, members of the Judiciary Committee in Washington, who we've already spoken with, some of their staff members, to make our case and why this is important for the preservation of American sound recordings. Oh, I want to say one more thing off the subject before I forget, because I've already forgotten. We found a pair of glasses in the break room, aviator glasses, chrome frames, and they're at the registration desk. So if you see anybody around grasping, if they're not here, please take them to the registration desk to get their glasses. Sorry. Thank you.
That's all right. Better to read copyright law. We have a couple of minutes left. Be glad to take questions from the floor. Yes.
I'm assuming that that this plan is going to address both mechanical and performance royalties, especially in light. Excuse me. I assume that these points are going to address both mechanical and performance royalties, as they apply in copyright law, especially with the extremely negative stance that BMI has been taking with large minimum licensing fees and web crawlers to find any kind of recorded music of any duration on the web.
You're talking about the compulsory licensing.
Yes.
That would have to be worked out in a way that makes sense for today's technology, obviously. And there's a good deal of history behind it. And there'll always be push and pull that the rights owners, as with web streaming, want more and the users want less. But the idea would be to open the door that it's not illegal to do anything, that there has to be a process, A, and B, it has to be a process where the pricing structure is open to public review. So, yes.
Tim, can I say something?
Sure, go ahead.
I also want to make sure I understood your question, because it might be addressing something that we haven't looked at entirely. If there's an issue about avarice from underlying rights holders in webcasting, if that's the question, we aren't really addressing music copyrights per se.
This is recording copyrights.
Yeah. But BMI doesn't cover recording copyright. So if there's something that needs to be looked at in terms of limitations on webcasting by the underlying rights holders, please bring it to our attention later.
Okay. Considering that the part of the RIAA argument is that the great harm that they suffer when things are pirated or copyright is ignored, have you looked at the study commissioned by the Australian Attorney General's Office that came out 6 months ago that essentially sounded like they disproved or said at least that the claims of the recording industry were wildly overblown and unprovable as to the harm that they supposedly suffer?
Yes. Philip Ruddock is the Attorney General, I believe, in Australia, who is the spokesman for this report. And if you look his name up on the web, you'll find a lot of stuff on this. And they were extremely skeptical of industry claims about the amounts of money that they were losing from downloading specifically. That study, as I understand it, which was meant sort of like the Gowers Commission to set a framework for Australian IP, was not aimed specifically at term limits or the kinds of things we were talking about here. It had more to do with being able to make taped copies, which we take for granted in this country, of television shows and current downloading, that kind of thing. So it was much more on the current industry and current practice than it was historical. But yes, you're right. It took a very skeptical view of industry claims of harm. And that is one of our aces in the hole, frankly. The industry claims are, I think, not taken on the same face value that they were 5 years ago. Maybe Sam, I haven't talked to Sam about this. In Washington, there have been a number of studies indicating that they're whining. And as I indicated, in England, that was a conclusion of the Gowers Commission. Gowers himself felt that this was an industry trying to hold on to its rights and not being competitive enough. So that's another example of that. Yes, question in the back.
One more.
I just wanted to address the point of industry complaints about loss of revenue. These complaints are centered, of course, in assets that are supposedly still valuable, which basically includes pop and maybe some jazz and soundtracks. My own experience with Sony BMG and Universal Classics Group certainly suggests that classical musical assets are not valued in the same way. They are not even being exploited in most cases by the copyright owners themselves, and I doubt very much if anyone would be interested in any activity that could be interpreted as illegal or unlawful with respect to that portion of their assets. So it's one more nail in the coffin of the argument that, oh, we're losing so much money as the result of this activity. You have to define it quite narrowly, it seems to me. What assets are they complaining about? It certainly does not, in my opinion, based on what I know, it does not relate to their classical music assets.
If you do get to the Gowers Commission report and don't have time to read the whole 100-page thing, go to page 48 to 57. That's where they address some of the very specific economic impact analyses that they did and cast considerable doubt on this, whoa, we're going to lose so much, and show how marginal this truly is and how skewed it truly is. The first time I've seen rigorous economic analysis of this, which is what moves legislators. I wish our passion moved them. Our passion helps, but economics moves them as well.
But this was based on classical music, so they do show an interest.
We can talk about Naxos. Naxos was a case that went out of control, basically. And
Dennis's point about classical music, though, they did make a concern about classical music specifically.
Right. Okay, thank you. Copyright Committee, please assemble up here. We'll find a cheap place to have lunch and continue our work. Thank you very much.